The Marine and the Hippie is a weekly conversation about current events aimed at presenting alternative viewpoints while looking for common ground. We are the Marine and the Hippie.
Welcome to the Marine and the Hippie. I'm Dylan. I'm the Hippie talking to you from Turkey. Today, we will be talking about getting in line. This idea that, well, queues and lines are part of society and that when we're in them, sometimes we don't want to be in them, but they do have a certain purpose and a certain characteristics that get us through the queue for the purpose. So even if I'm at the queue at the grocery store, I'm getting in, you know, I get in line, I wait, get my turn, buy my things, give money, and leave. My ancestors, Italian, Irish, French, German, Jew, and Catholic, all came over through New York, through Ellis Island. And, well, they got off boats. And when they got off a boat, they got in line. And they were checked into Ellis Island. And some last names were kept the same. Some last names were changed. Our vaccines were given. And it was all in the process of becoming an American. And today, that getting in line seems to have shifted. And that's what we're going to talk about today is what does it mean to get in line today? Doc.
Yes, this topic came up as a result of the recent events in Afghanistan. As anyone who's not been under a rock for the last month is aware, the United States finally ended the longest war in our history, almost 20-year-long war, where we invaded Afghanistan following September 11th, 2001. We occupied the country for two decades or a whole generation. We saw instances where fathers fought in the war early and then sons followed their father into the war, 5 or 10 years later. There's all kinds of instances where that happened. And then we finally decided we're going to leave. And that our departure is causing a larger refugee crisis to start in and around Afghanistan, where people are both internally displaced as well as, being forced to move out of the country to free themselves from the fear of the incoming Taliban. And this only adds to the number of different refugee crises that are going on in the region at the current moment. There's refugee crises that have been where Palestinians have been forced out of Israel for the last 50 or 70 years and have been living as refugees in Jordan in a permanent state of refugee camp. There's refugees in Yemen who are internally displaced from the war down there. There's all kinds of refugees from the Syrian crisis. And so to some degree, we have caused a lot of these problems ourselves, the United States, has caused a lot of the problems that have led to these refugee crises. And yet we're so unwilling to, give the people who are fleeing these, these internal and external wars an opportunity to, as Dylan says, get in line to come and actually, live in this country so they can actually be free of all the problems that are being caused in that region. And so the idea that we, need to put people in a 4-year-long queue before they're even considered for any kind of resident alien status or a green card is much different than the experience that a lot of the folks who came to this country in the 19th century and the early 20th century experienced. As Dylan mentioned, my ancestors as well hopped off of a boat. They literally got in line at some station. They had their name written down in a book and they were given a green card. And 4 years later, they became citizens. And a lot of times they became citizens right after the Civil War, where they had to go fight in the Civil War. But they would have been citizens. It was just they were accepted. They're welcomed and they were accepted. And nowadays things aren't like that.
While you're speaking, you're talking about war, and it just kind of an idea popped into my head. And it seems like a lot of the times when we think of war, we think of it as maybe a movie or a video game. It's this thing that we play Battleship. you across the table from me, I sunk your battleship. And then we close the game, we put it away, and we move on with our day. And a lot of the time, I don't think we actually think about what are the long-term effects of war. Doc brought up Afghanistan. People are internally displaced. Some people are being forced externally because of different ideologies or different belief systems from the people who have taken, the Taliban who have taken over power, and they want out. They're saying, hey, we don't want to be part of this. We are not part of this. We don't want to be part of the new government, the new effect from a 20-year war. But they have no place to go. But we started the war. we went in, we started the war, and one of the effects of starting a war is finishing a war. And finishing a war might be just clicking a button and everybody dies. Or it means helping the people who are saying, yeah, we want to be refugees. We want to be out and away from what is there and what is being offered to us in our country of origin, which in this case, if we're just going to talk about Afghanistan today, is Afghanistan. So as the nation that started the war, we have an obligation, and also an obligation, a commitment, and also a history that's built on the fact that we are a nation of all, not a nation of few, that we are accepting of other nations, we are accepting of other religions, other ideologies, and that we want these people to come in and help them to assimilate to become America. And I think too many people right now either don't understand this, or those who do understand it like things so much the way that they are that they're unwilling to see anyone come in who may change what society looks like as a whole. And I think that that might be one of the problems. Doc, what do you think?
Well, I think right after break, we can get into this a little bit further. But I liked what you said, that we have an obligation to the people. We do have an obligation to the people whose homes we destroyed, whose country we, you know, in many cases bombed for 20 years, over whose territory we fought a very long protracted struggle. We have an obligation to those people to somehow make them whole for the damage that we've done. I don't know how the United States could possibly make Afghanistan whole after doing what we've done for the last 20 years. We've dumped $2 trillion into that country by some conservative estimates, and we haven't really gotten a lot for it. We've got a lot of buildings that have been built in places where they're not being used, and we funded a lot of warlords who are going to continue, you know, their poppy production. But we'll talk a little bit more about this after the break. You're listening to Marine and the Hippie. This is Dialogue Number 24. Get in line. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Marine and the Hippie.
Hello, this is Dialogue Number 24 on The Marine and the Hippie. I am The Marine, Doc, and I'm coming at you live once again from Ames, Iowa. We took a little break over the month of August because August is just, you know, who wants to work during August? You know, it's very hot and it's miserable in the Northern Hemisphere, and so we decided to take a little break and regroup and get our feet back under us, catch our breath, and then we're coming back at a very, very momentous time, September 11th, 2021, 20 years after the attacks on, you know, the World Trade Center and the beginning of the Afghanistan War. We're finally wrapping it up. We're finally ending and leaving out of there. And we've created a refugee crisis. And so now we're talking about what we owe to the people of Afghanistan and also other refugees of other conflicts that we've had our hand in and have helped create both in the region and internationally. And one thing I really want to point out, and I have a kind of a nuanced view of the refugee situation in Afghanistan. On the one hand, I believe that we owe something to those people that staked their own health and their own safety in helping the United States. For better or worse, we might be the bad guys, whatever. We can leave that to history to decide. But we did get people who lived there to help us in terms of translation, in terms of, you know, on the ground intelligence and that kind of stuff, who are now, you know, possibly being threatened by the incoming Taliban government. We owe them to some degree, you know, a measure of safety and security for their decision to help us. But on the other hand, there's a ton of people that want to leave Afghanistan because they don't want to live under the Taliban. And many of those people include doctors, bureaucrats, professionals of all kinds. And do we, in the United States, do we support a refugee movement that allows those professionals, those middle-class people, the people that could play a role in keeping Afghanistan going, do we allow them to flee the whole country and just leave the country, you know, to the Taliban, who is extremely motivated in ruling the country, and the people that are left there that have no skills and no way to get out of Afghanistan. Dylan, what are your thoughts?
If people don't know something, they don't know it. So if you don't know that Coca-Cola exists, you don't know that ATMs exists, you don't know the internet exists, and you live in a mud hut and life goes on as it's gone on for millennia, that's great. The problem is when we meddle, when we play the puppet master role a little bit, we create a problem. And what we do is we create a middle class, and we create doctors and lawyers and bureaucracy and people who have been educated and who over 20 years, as you said, generational, who have made money, who have gone to parents who have made money, sent their kids to college in the US or in Europe, and then the kids have come back to build up a society that's kind of on the bridge between Western civilization and Middle Eastern civilization. And do we owe, should those people, Doc brings up the question, should they be able to leave? Well, they can't go back to living in the mud hut. That's the problem. They can't go back. You can't go backwards once you've gotten off the donkey and gotten into the car. You don't want to ride the donkey anymore. It's not comfortable enough. But if it's all you know, you're going to ride the donkey. And so again, it's cause and effect. We don't look at these long-term effects of society and what we're going to do with people and how we're going to help them. Instead, we say, well, we're going in this, it's a righteous war. Okay, sure, that's fine. I'm not the guy making the decision of why we're going to war. Do I think it's righteous? Doesn't matter. Somebody thought it was, and that's why we went. But we're not looking at the long-term effect that we know is going to happen, where people are going to be displaced. I live in Turkey. I live in a country that is literally on the bridge between Europe and the Middle East. And it brings up a whole bunch of issues every day. Because yes, there are people who still ride donkeys in Eastern Turkey. And there's people who drive in Mercedes. Person who rides a donkey doesn't give, just lives their life that like they have been doing probably for 3,000 years or longer. But the guy who drives the Mercedes, he doesn't want to go back to driving the donkey. And that's for everyone. So women who suddenly are allowed to, in conservative culture, women who are allowed to wear bikinis at the beach, like my girlfriend. We went to the beach yesterday. We went swimming. She was wearing a bikini. If she was forced now to wear a burqa to go swimming, she wouldn't accept it. But a different government would force that upon her. And yes, so we do have an obligation to help these people and probably to either to bring them in to under our fold, because that's what we've offered them. We have offered them Western civilization. So we need to be able to take these refugees who have developed their lives based on Western civilization and allow them to continue with the product that we've sold them. Doc.
Okay, so the counterpoint to that, and not saying I disagree with you, I'm unclear in my own mind about which is the proper solution to this problem. Should we take out the middle class that we've helped develop and leave Afghanistan to the mud huts and the donkeys? You know, I would suggest that the people of Afghanistan don't necessarily like riding donkeys when they look over and see their neighbor driving a Mercedes. And, you know, just because they can't afford the Mercedes themselves don't mean that they don't want one. But that's a very materialistic attitude. And the counterpoint that I have is that after the Cuban Revolution, the United States adopted policies that encouraged a brain drain and a professional drain out of Cuba. Now, Cuba was a very advanced society that happened to have a large peasant class in the country that was deliberately created and kept poor, you know, on starvation for the purposes of allowing this middle class and the upper class of Cuban society to own land, to create wealth for themselves, and to not have to actually work. And so they created and maintained this peasant class. The peasants knew exactly what they were missing. It's not that they didn't know what the rich folks in Havana had. It's just that they couldn't get a hold of any of it. They had no access to it because they were dirt poor all the time and they were unemployed 10 months out of the year. And so this was a deliberate thing. Now, after the Cuban Revolution, when the communists took over, the United States adopted policies which encouraged a massive refugee exodus from Cuba, where the middle class and the upper class basically took not only all their professional skills, but also all of their, you know, all of their wealth and drained it out of the country, so that Cuba was left with basically nothing except subsistence agriculture and monoculture and sugar. And they were left to the, you know, you might say, they were left to the mercy, at the mercy of communists. There was nobody in the country anymore that could actually like oppose or counterbalance the communists. And so that's the counterpoint to that. And you know, that would, in Afghanistan, it would be not communists, but Taliban that were leaving the people to the mercy of.
When we come back, we'll continue talking about get in line and assimilation at the end of the day. Look forward to talking to you after break.
Hi, this is Doc, and you're listening to Marine and the Hippie.
Welcome to back to the Marine and the Hippie, episode 24, Get in Line. Before a break, Doc had brought up the example of Cuba and, you know, peasant farming and how after the kind of fall of communism, there was an exodus of wealth out of Cuba, not only financial, but also intellectual. And Doc brought up the question, what should we do when we're looking at Afghanistan? And as somewhat of a boot on the ground, so to speak, somebody who lives in the region, I would offer this as my answer. I don't think that the person who's been living the same way for 3,000 years as a peasant farmer really cares. I think they might look at the Mercedes or the BMW and say, yeah, that's something that I desire to have. But if they're still cooking in the steel pot with fire, their relationship to who's leading them, it doesn't matter as much, if at all, because they're still at the point of, well, I need to feed myself and I need to clothe myself. My property takes 20 hours of my day. My chickens need tending. My sheep need to be walked. And when we live in a society like that, or people who live in a society like that, or see people living in a society like that, who is their leader matters. But it doesn't matter as much as somebody who's looking for freedom. Doc?
So this goes back to the question of obligation then. We have an obligation, okay? Let's you know, I'll just stipulate, to use the legal term, that we do have an obligation to get those professional middle-class folks that we helped create out of that country. All right, just for the sake of argument, I'll give you that. Don't we have an obligation then also to the people who are left behind, whose country we critically destroyed, whose infrastructure we critically destroyed, in our war against the, you know, terrorists and against the Taliban insurgents and whatnot? Don't we have an obligation to the people living in a dirt hut who are tending their chickens 20 hours a day to make sure that they at least have some opportunity to have a good government, maybe not Western style liberalism? I mean, I'm not saying we need to impose that upon anyone, but you can't say that a theocratic Taliban government is a good government. Don't we have some obligation to the people who are left behind then as well? And in that case, should we then depopulate the whole country of Afghanistan to get all those people out of there so the only people left in Afghanistan are Taliban? What do you think?
Yeah, I don't think they know, to be honest. I think when I go running in the mountains and I come across families and people have been living in villages like this for years and years and years, who's in the role of leadership doesn't matter. The only time it does matter is if they go to war, because nobody's coming really looking for them. Yeah, there are some issues that need to be addressed on a humanitarian scale, maybe through legislation, diplomacy, and kind of, I don't want to use the word, but it's the only one that's popping into my head, meddling of the United Nations, saying this is how you're going to have to be, or there will be another war. Maybe I think I'm thinking specifically about how women are treated, especially young girls. But yeah, no, I don't think we have an obligation to the whole country. But on the other side, I think we have an obligation to allow people who do choose to escape the Taliban rule for whatever reason, an obligation, moral and civic, to help them get in line, get through the process in a timely fashion, medically get their vaccines, basic knowledge of English so they can come in and communicate effectively, and help them move forward. The problem is, in America in 2021, and this is probably how every episode that I end ends, the problem is that we don't have anything really to offer our own people. So our own people are struggling, and they're afraid of other people coming in, because those other people are going to come in and they're going to do the work of jobs that they, that are available. They're going to live in apartments and such and make it harder for others. And those others, in this case, turn out to be fellow Americans, because we don't have a country that supports its own people. We don't have socialized medicine. We don't have universal basic income. We don't have free higher education. And until we square that away, there's always going to be a group of angry Americans blocking the line, saying, we don't want people coming in. We don't want you here changing our system. Doc, why don't you end this off?
I think it's encouraging, and as a matter of full disclosure, you can correct me if I'm wrong when I say this, but I believe that you and I have come to some agreement with regard to the notion that the type of government or who rules the country doesn't matter at all to most people. And we can see that in this country too. They could care less. The only thing they really care about is whether or not the person has an R or a D next to their name. The vast majority of the people, and they just want to go back to their lives. Once the election's over, they want to stop caring about it. Same way with the peasants in Afghanistan who are going to be ruled by the Taliban, whether we like it or not. Their lives are not measurably going to change at all, you know, from the way that they've lived for the past 3,000 years. Just like our lives don't fundamentally change at all when we have Democrats in charge as opposed to when we have Republicans in charge. We like to think it does. It doesn't change at all. I think we do have an obligation to help the interpreters out. So I think that, whether or not they actually have to get in line like my ancestors had to, they'll probably have a much longer, much more involved line that takes years and years and years for them to complete the process, and the vast majority of them will probably get kicked out of the line at some point and get sent back to Afghanistan anyway. You've been listening to Dialogue number 24, The Marines and the Hippie. As usual, I am the Marine, and Dylan is the Hippie. And if you want to get a hold of Marine and the Hippie, you know where to call it. Contact us. We're at marinehippie.com. And we got all of our Twitter information there, all of our Gmail information there. You can write us. Let us know what you think. Tell us how great it is that we're back in your life after a month and a half break. And tell us whatever
thanks
you want.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. Talk to you later.
Ciao.
Hey, this is Doc.
And this is Dylan.
And you're listening to Marine and the Hippie.
For more information on the Marine, follow Doc at Supernova_Earth on Twitter and listen to the Supernova Earth Show on Spotify. For more information on the Hippie, follow Dylan at Gezi and Me on Twitter and read his blog at observationsfromthespectrum.org.